Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Mike Rupert, a former LAPD narcotics investigator who has been very heroically crusading against the intelligence community's involvement in the narcotics traffic, and he is the editor of the From the Wilderness newsletter, about which we'll have more to say at the end of the broadcast. Mike, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Oh, pleasure, Dave.
Before we left off at the last half of the last half hour, we were talking about Catherine Austin Fitz, your contributing editor, and some of the discoveries that she made as an assistant secretary of HUD when she began putting some of the pieces of the puzzle together, namely what she had seen and what puzzled her to an extent as assistant secretary of HUD under George Bush, and some of the things that you were able to point out to her about some of the areas in Los Angeles which HUD was interested in and which were also a focal point of some of the narcotics traffic, some of the cocaine traffic that was discussed in the Gary Webb Dark Alliance series.
Mm-hmm.
Now, once again, so that we can resume the thread of the discussion, Catherine discovered that the areas that she was interested in or involved with as assistant secretary of HUD and some of Freeway Ricky Ross's stomping grounds were one and the same, and she came to some hard conclusions about some of the macroeconomics and macropolitics involved. If you would briefly sum that up for us again.
Actually, she and I both came to the same conclusions, which is, to put it in one sentence, it's that America is more hooked on drug money than it is on drugs. Very simple. That much of the Wall Street, the current Wall Street expansion and the big bubble on Wall Street is financed as a result of cheap capital made available through drugs, that we now live in an economy which is based upon destroying things. In other words, companies which trade on Wall Street benefit through something called the POP, which is roughly what you would know as the price-to-earnings ratio. In other words, if I have a company which has $10 million in net income, If I'm a major Wall Street company, let's say like General Electric, the price to earnings or the POP on that can be roughly 30 times, so that my stock value based on 10 million of net income can be 300 million. Well, when you're dealing now with let's say $1 billion in sale, you see $30 billion. These numbers get very, very huge, and sometimes they have very little to do with actual productivity, let's say, or with actual wealth creation. But if I have a company, let's say, for example, Corrections Corporation of America, or Wackenhut, which trade publicly, and I am charged with running private prisons, my stock value is based upon the number of dollars I get, which is based upon the number of people I incarcerate. And Wackenhut's website has a flashing number indicating the number of bodies they currently house who are sentenced to prison terms, most of them nonviolent drug offenders. But leaving that as aside, I mean, that's a very gross example, but much more simply, General Electric, it's very well documented, and I've written about this in the Department of Justice documents, money laundering, where the South American drug lords will launder their drug profits by buying, let's say, $100 million in consumer goods, and GE sells easily $100 million a year worth of televisions, refrigerators, appliances, VCRs in the Southern Hemisphere. Well, $100 million in net income for General Electric equates to $3 billion increase in its stock value on Wall Street. Now, the heads of all the major corporations on Wall Street are paid in stock options. Now, General Electric, and I'm sure you know this, owns NBC.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, there is no interest in General Electric allowing and or encouraging NBC to tell the truth about how much drug money is out there or what it is doing to the economy. And we see a classic case in point with the current breaking scandal, and I'm doing a large piece on the Bank of New York at 1 Wall Street. That's their address.
Mm-hmm.
And Bank of New York has recently been caught or exposed for laundering what may well be in excess of $12 billion in Russian organized crime money, admittedly charging fees to launder this illegal money of up to $250 million a month, and what may be a scandal that will show that more than $130 billion has been looted out of Russia by organized crime and criminal factions in the last 10 to 12 years. Now, $130 billion, Dave, leaving Russia is the looting of the entire country. Its wealth has been moved here, probably in advance of Y2K. But certainly, it's not a situation that any country can sustain. And that's why we see martial law emerging under the new premier or prime minister, Putin, I guess you would say it if you're a Russian, who is a KGB operative. And we see all these buildings mysteriously being blown up and all these new draconian law enforcement measures being put in place because Russia is on the brink of total implosion. And if you notice, I think it was just within the last 48 hours, the British government has issued travel advisories for all of its citizens to stay out of Russia and the Ukraine come New Year's.
I've been speculating on air, Mike, obviously not in our discussions, but about who might be behind it. And I suspect that there are a lot of things that are coming to play in the former Soviet Union. I think the geopolitics of oil probably has a lot to do with that. They do not want, for example, Dagestan, where the Islamic rebels have been active. By the way, they also have their genesis with the Afghan war, and that was the largest of the U.S. covert operations of the 80s. But Dagestan has 70% of Russia's shoreline on the Caspian Sea, which is a major oil up. The center. So I think oil has a lot to do. There are a lot of other things as well. But rather, before we get to the issue, if we have time, about Russia, I'd like to delve into the Catherine Austin Fitz situation at greater length, if we could.
Sure.
If you would finish your train of thought in that regard, but I want to get things back to what Ms. Fitz has had to say, because it is not only very devastating, very, very important, but I think the source that it comes from is worth noting. And I'd like to, if we have time, read a couple of short excerpts about some of her observations about some of the official attitudes towards African-Americans on the part of people in government. But if you would develop further, what Catherine, with regard to the pop and where we're going on that, if you finish your thought on Russia, but I'd like to stick with the Catherine Fitz scenario.
Okay. Well, just to say that briefly about Russia, I mean, we are doing anything and everything we can to sustain a drastically overinflated Wall Street investment bubble, which, in Catherine's opinion as well as in mine, has to pop sometime soon. That's a bad pun on the pop, by the way.
Right.
But Catherine makes the point. She says very simply, she says, look, all of these major mergers and acquisitions are financed by LBOs, leveraged buyouts,
mm-hmm.
Which is where the company buying the second company in the merger borrows the money. Now, the reason why they want to do that, like I say, is let's say I'm Pepsi-Cola and I buy a company that sells $1 million worth of orange juice a year. My stock value just went up $30 million as a result. That's what's happening with the bubble on Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
So it's easy for me to pay $26 million for a company that's only selling $1 million worth of orange juice. Okay, so let's say on a larger scale that I am a Goldman Sachs or I am a Dean Witter or a Morgan Stanley or any one of the investment banks, and I'm in an all-out war to buy a company. Let's say it's RJR Nabisco. That's just a term that everybody's familiar with. I can go to Bankers Trust, I can go to Deutsche Bank, I can go anywhere I want to and borrow the money in the LBO, probably at 8-10% or whatever the interest rate is, to buy out this other company. Or I can go offshore and I can borrow drug money laundered once in the Cayman Islands. It's perfectly legal and I can pay 5% for that. Now, for anybody who has ever financed a car in their whole life, you know that the interest rate basically determines what kind of a car you can afford to get. If you're going to borrow for a car loan at 9%, you can afford, let's say, a $15,000 car. But if you get the same car loan for a special of 2.2%, you know, from one, you know, or whatever, you can buy a $22,000 car, and your payments are going to be exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's exactly the way Wall Street works. So basically, the drug economy, which now, according to the UN, is $440 billion a year, $200 billion being laundered through the U.S., which equates to a cash multiplier effect of $1.2 trillion circulating in the U.S. economy, really governs our current economy. And that's the big, dark, dirty secret that nobody can let out of the closet. But it's hitting us it's the elephant in the middle of the living room.
And one of the interesting things is, too, not only are we ignoring this, but, of course, the civil liberties in this country are being absolutely tossed out the window in order to combat the very drug menace, which is being created to a considerable extent by our own government.
Yeah, we have become a snake eating its own tail,
right,
which is not nutritious.
Right. And going back to what Catherine Fitz discovered, though, about the link between the, where the cocaine was going in the 1980s and where HUD was financing properties, and where that, in turn, the cocaine epidemic was leading to foreclosures and basically a huge ripoff. In the past, touching on that, we've referred to that as ethnic cleansing. I don't think that's too great an exaggeration.
No, you could easily use the term genocide. It works fine with me, too.
Yeah, and this is not something that is paranoid conspiracy theory. We all have to labor under that moniker these days. But rather, this is an ongoing fact of life. And I think that a lot of people, Mike, who listen to these programs, have a difficult time envisioning some of what we say simply because they cannot conceive of that level of evil. And, Ed, with your permission, I'd like to read just a couple of short excerpts from Catherine's article in your latest edition of From the Wilderness.
Please.
This is the article called The Story of Edgewood Technology Services Part 1, or How I Lost $100 Million Discovering Who Makes Money Making Sure the Popsicle Index Does Not Go Up. And this is a section called The Elderly, Women and Kids, Head 'em Up, Move 'em Out. And after discussing her plan to basically contract out data processing to some of the actual residents of some of these projects who could thereby get off welfare or maximize their income, at the same time as saving the government the cost of contracting out the data processing, Catherine then resumes the discussion and talks about what she met with in terms of officialdom when she tried to get these ideas into actuated. And Catherine writes, and again, this is from the Wilderness, Volume 2, Number 6, August 30th, 1999. One deeply honest and sincere Clinton administration appointee then expressed concern for Hamilton's exposure. Hamilton, of course, is her company. I was planning on starting in African American communities first. Black people were hopeless, I was told. I should focus instead on neighborhoods with Hispanic or Asian immigrants. The Afro-American poor could never be and would never be relevant in an information economy. Their circumstances reflected their own lack of ability. They required a warehousing solution, as they were not needed for the workforce and were irrelevant to the productivity of a knowledge-based society. Re-engineering incentive systems or access to education and capital was not enough. These were people who could not be productive. I disagreed. All of the American people are the assets. We are not some swing workforce to be liquidated and moved around for the benefit of this week's vision of an industrial society formed to serve elites. Besides, where we stand should be determined by our performance, making sure that we have no access to knowledge or capital, and then saying that an elite one on performance is ya-ya. This will kill the country's learning speed. Competition increases learning speeds. Those who win in a rigged game get stupid. A few months later, I had dinners with members of a think tank in Washington who were close to then-Speaker Newt Gingrich. The producer of Gingrich's cable TV show joined us at dinner. She was more direct. These people were hopeless. The state of poverty in poor black communities reflected the bad values of the children themselves. I asked if this applied to 7-year-olds. She said, yes, the living conditions of the children reflected the bad values of the children. The implication was that black genetic inferiority meant that society would be better off if such people were dead. This from the producer of Newt Gingrich's TV show. And I interject that at this point, Mike, because I think that there may be members of the audience who could not imagine such evil, at least in the United States, and I want to assure them that it is not only very real, but we have a first-hand witness in the case of Catherine Fitz.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a way of life that they adopt, which I guess under other circumstances we would have say is a perverted version of noblesse oblige, or you know, the ruling class's view of, oh, these people demand. The American public demands that we give them all this money and maintain their standard of living, and we have to keep coming up with these creative ways to make all this money to keep everybody happy, and we have to destroy things and have wars and wars on drugs and spend this money and all the things that they have to do in Washington to keep the campaign donors happy. I mean, it's very cynical, but it's very real.
It is indeed. And one of the things I've noticed, you know, Catherine was Assistant Secretary of HUD. Wasn't Jack Kemp the Housing Secretary or HUD Secretary?
Correct, he was.
He also has had a lot of boost in his political career from the Pioneer Fund, which is a eugenics organization formed in 1937. And Harry Laughlin, the co-founder whose name I couldn't remember earlier in the show, and Frederick Osborne, the co-founders not only endorsed the Nazi racial legislation, but they in turn received honoraria from the Nazi-dominated academe and a piece of legislation that was drawn up by Harry Laughlin called the Model Eugenic Sterilization Law was simply adapted into German and became the Law for the Prevention of Hereditarily Ill Progeny, the very first of the Nazi racial laws. And the Pioneer Fund was behind the racist bestseller, The Bell Curve, which maintained that blacks were genetically inferior to whites. And the quote research in that book, which topped the New York Times bestseller list, came from Pioneer Fund. I find it interesting that Catherine has encountered these types of ideas, which dovetail with what The Bell Curve had to say and with what Hitler had to say, and she finds them extant in the milieu of which her superior, Jack Kemp, supported by the Pioneer Fund, was holding sway over.
Well, Catherine and I have several things in common, one of which is that the man who got her her job, got her the appointment at HUD, Craig Fuller, who was head of the transition team from Vice President Bush to President Bush's move into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Fuller had been my closest friend through 4 years at UCLA from 69 through 73. And I recall one day in 70, 71, I don't recall exactly, but Craig and I were walking across campus, and I was interning at LAPD, having been especially chosen to intern for the chief of police, Ed Davis, here, by CIA connections, talking about drugs, and Craig made this offhand comment that it's just weeding out the gene pool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just totally offhand. But, of course, that's where these elites who have played in a rigged game for so long have gotten stupid, because it wasn't just blacks who suffered. There were so many white middle class and upper kids who got eaten up by the drug plague as well.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know? I'm just pointing out the common political heritage between Hitler and some of the people involved in HUD when Catherine was there, and who were expressing ideas that Hitler would be extremely comfortable with.
Those ideas and those practices, when one is removed from the hypnosis of mass media in this country and just gets to look at events as they happen rather than as they are packaged and sold to us, one can basically make a very good argument that the Third Reich did not lose the Second World War, it just changed venues.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. And indeed, that was pretty much how they viewed things. When the Reinhard Gehlen outfit and the Project Paperclip people and in South America, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization all coalesced after the war, it was just basically, let us continue, as LBJ said, after JFK's assassination. Mike, other things that you talked about, either in the latest edition of From the Wilderness or in some of the stuff we've talked about in previous interviews, did you want to develop the situation with Catherine further? Because I know there are more articles coming out, and we will talk about that in the future.
Just to say briefly, and this is by way of teasing in future issues coming out, we are going to be telling the story of how after the Detroit riots in 1967, the Kerner Commission, which had a number of people connected to the intelligence community and the military-industrial complex sitting on it, devised a program and actually put into writing a concept called spatial deconcentration, which basically said that no more than one-fourth of the population of any major inner city should be minority, and it was enshrined after the Detroit riots. We will be having input from Professor John Metzger from the University of Michigan, as well as a number of experts working with Catherine and me to also describe how an activist in Washington, D.C., Yolanda Ward, was murdered in 1980 for trying to expose the eugenic, ethnic cleansing, if you will, genocidal aspects of American inner-city housing policy, all of which turn out to be very closely connected to CIA and drugs. So we'll over the next 3, 4, 5 months from the wilderness, we'll be looking at those issues very closely and a lot of detail.
All righty, and at the end of the show, again, we'll give the details about how to subscribe to From the Wilderness. And by the way, I don't get any monies from the wilderness or any sort of reciprocal activity or compensation. Mike, very briefly, Colombia. It's been a major drug epicenter for quite some time. It's been undergoing some shifts. You touched on it earlier. Obviously, there have been moves in that direction by elements of our national security establishment. What do you see happening, and on what do you base your prognostications, bearing in mind we've only got a few minutes left?
Okay. Colombia is extremely important, and it's very important to note that 10 years ago, Colombia was not the major drug-producing nation. Most of the cocaine, and we now consume roughly 500 metric tons a year in the U.S., was grown, produced in Bolivia and Peru. However, Colombia has now become the largest producer of cocaine, or coca leaf, in the world, growing it. But a DEA report, a law enforcement-sensitive DEA report, which I have, from about a year and a half ago, states that the only reason that Colombian heroin does not dominate the U.S. market is that there is not enough of it. And recent CIA reports from this year state that Colombia has increased its coca crop by 28% this year, and the heroin crop is doubling, roughly. Colombia is now the largest drug-producing nation in the world, using almost exclusively the Dominicans. And if you look on a map, Colombia and from Colombia to New York, almost directly in a straight line, right in the middle, is the Dominican Republic and Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And Dominican gangs control all of the drug trade, roughly, on the most of it on the eastern seaboard. Now, what's interesting, as people like Barry McCaffrey bewail the Colombian guerrillas and the military, and people complain about the military junta on the right and the communist guerrillas on the left and the paramilitaries in the middle, and every news story always says the military connected to the drug trade, the Colombian rebels connected to the drug trade. You know, the funny thing is that no matter what's happening in Colombia, Colombia has always been increasing its drug production, which means the cartels really run the country.
Mm-hmm.
And everything else is subterfuge, camouflage, and just people fighting for positions. The real threat out of Colombia for U.S. economic interest is that Colombia is becoming an economic power, which threatens the U.S. drug-financed economy. And we witnessed, and I covered this in From the Wilderness in July, that Richard Grasso, the president of the New York Stock Exchange, actually went and drove up in the mountains and visited with Colombian guerrillas, the FARC rebels, the so-called communists, and he was making a cold call, asking them to put their drug money back into the stock exchange. So if we go to war in Colombia, it will not be because it's either so-called communist guerrillas or the military or whatever the case. It's to prevent Colombia from becoming so economically powerful as a drug-producing shipping nation that it can, if you will, blackmail our economy. And I see a strong connection there with the recent pardon of FALN guerrillas in New York. Yes, and I agree that Bill Clinton may have been doing some political stunt maneuvering on Hillary's benefit, but the closest military bases to Colombia where all of the military intervention would take place are all in Puerto Rico. And Clinton and the CIA and the military would need to assure domestic stability on the island that U.S. troops and equipment would not be molested while staging there to invade another Latin country.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that was part of the quid pro quo for the release.
All righty. That certainly is something to consider. Another aspect that I'd like to touch on, and we're down to our last couple of minutes. People often, when they listen to the programs that I do, they get depressed, they get scared, because they don't feel there's anything they can do. And as I said earlier, I think you and Catherine Austin Fitz are exemplary in this regard. Get busy, stick your neck out, take some shots, put yourself at risk, and you can get something done. I mean, just talking on 700 radio stations about the George W. cocaine connection is a lot of activity in placing oneself at risk. Something we've spoken about before, Mike, is the class action lawsuits that are being filed against CIA by people in inner cities. If you could review that for us and perhaps update us on any new developments in that regard.
Absolutely. And, you know, thank you for making that point, because I am proud and I am pleased to say, and I by no means assert that I have been able to accomplish this by myself. I have had a lot of friends and a lot of support along the way. But You can do something, and how do I know that? Because we have done some things, one of which is the simultaneous filing of class action suits against the CIA, Department of Justice, the estates of Bill Casey, Robert Gates, and the whole Contra crew, as a result of Volume 2 of the CIA's Inspector General Report, released last October the 8th, which gives us, using the tobacco lawsuit model, a perfect class action suit, just that the CIA and the government looked the other way when the cocaine was coming in. They knew it was going to be harmful. They entered into a conspiracy to not tell the American public that it was coming in or to advise law enforcement. That's very straightforward. We don't have to subpoena any documents. This is not a replay of Christic with Great Expectations. We have the case already made. The Oakland City Council in July unanimously endorsed, I mean unanimously, after a strong recommendation from the city attorney, the class action suits. Why? Because they smelled money on the table. And as a result of that, the House Intelligence Committee, which had been intending to close out its whole investigation from the Gary Webb stories in Volume 2, which is absolute proof that CIA dealt drugs, has been foreclosed. We have stopped them from closing out Volume 2. Now, I had a hand in starting those lawsuits. I flew up to San Francisco and met with attorneys up there, Katja Komisarek and Bill Simpich, in February, and we got them, and I sold them on the suits, and we got them filed. Now, what's happening now is, and this is news for you and your readers, is that the House Intelligence Committee and I are negotiating, and they are flying five investigators out to my little apartment office in Sherman Oaks to copy all of my files in October so that they can review the files, because they can't close out Volume 2 now. We have successfully prevented them politically from doing it. And the longer we keep Volume 2 open, the more we have a shot at forcing open, well-publicized hearings on Volume 2. And the longer it stays an issue, the more it hurts George W. Bush. So I, for one, and there's a whole list of other things that we collectively have accomplished. From the Wilderness certainly was involved in all of them, but that we have accomplished, which absolutely prove that you can do something. And if nothing else, you can stop spending your money on media that doesn't tell you the truth, and
yep.
You can spend it on media that does.
And one of the things that I encourage listeners to do is to sort of commission themselves as nodes of information transfer. It sounds like a weird thing to say, but use the internet, use talk shows, absorb the information you get here, and then pass it on to other people. Copy articles, copy excerpts of books, and do what you can to relay the information to others, because it is something people want to know about, and they will respond up to a point.
You're reading my mind, because we are just going to go with a whole new marketing scheme that I'm trying to get designed now, and basically it's this. The back issues of my newsletter are in very strong demand because they're being used as reference. So what I'm going to do is, within the next month or so, I'm going to waive all of my ownership and copyright to all prior editions to From the Wilderness, which means that I'm going to encourage that homeless people, homeless activists, anybody who wants to start a business, print out all of my issues and start selling them and keep all the money for yourself.
Okay, and Mike, we're almost out of time. Give them the particulars about how to get a hold of the newsletter, website, email, etc.
Okay. For the current issue, which is the only one I get to sell, which is going to be the current issue, for all the information, you can go to my website, which is at www.copvcia.com. You can email me at mrupert, R-U-P-P-E-R-T, at copvcia.com. You can write to me at Post Office Box 6061-350. In Sherman Oaks, California, and that's 91413. That's address it all to From the Wilderness, and we'll be happy to give you whatever information we can. You can find out how to subscribe, and we, have tons of reports and videotapes and all that stuff, and it's a great way to get involved, because we give you the how-to kits for also what to do to make a difference, not just to feed you a bunch of information to make you think it's hopeless.
All righty. And, I can't say anything to top that, except to encourage listeners to follow up on the information you just got. Mike, it's been fabulous, as always, visiting with you, and we'll have you back again real soon.
Dave, I always enjoy it with you, because you always know what you're talking about so well.
All righty. Well, for Mike Rupert, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.